It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Good afternoon, Interior Fairbanks. This is Randy Zarnke, your host for a program we call Alaska Tracks. We listen to segments of interviews I recorded with veteran outdoorsmen and women from throughout Alaska. These folks share stories and observations from their lives in the great outdoors of our great state. In today's episode, we'll be hearing from a gentleman by the name of Bud Wheezy. I don't use that term gentleman lightly here. Bud was polite, soft-spoken, and non-judgmental. I met Bud here in Fairbanks, where he was a mainstay of the outdoor community. He seemed to attend every meeting of consequence. Bud would sit quietly, listening to the proceedings, and wait his turn to speak. When the discussion finally came around to Bud, everyone would listen intently because we all knew that he had both a breadth and depth of experience. Last week, we heard the first half of the interview with Bud. Today, we'll pick up with his personal hunting adventures. In this first segment, he talks about his big game hunts and aerial wolf hunting.
In the fall of 46, my buddy from North Dakota, Bob Boyd, had showed up in Fairbanks. We knew each other, and in fact, we hunted together back in North Dakota, Bob Boyd and I, so we were naturals to get going to start hunting. Well, that fall, I didn't have a good rifle for hunting game, and Bill Biemeyer had a 30 Newton, and he had 7 shells for it. So Bill and I and a guy named Jennings Johnson went out looking for moose, and we found a black bear. Jennings took the first shot and the bear took off, and I made a snapshot and I got the bear. So that was one shell gone. It was down on Goldstream. I think we went down on what was the old Wood Road, part of the old Nenana Road, and Quinto Paulini put a road in down there on Goldstream side. And I'm sure that we was on that road when we spotted the bear, and he was down there eating blueberries, and we went down and got it. It was a small black bear, but it was one of the best eating bears I've ever had in my life. It was just fantastic. When we got back to town, Bill Biemeyer wanted to go moose hunting. So we went up. There was a mining road goes in where the old Murphy Dome Road took off at the head of Fox Gulch. And it went down what they call Big El Dorado. Comes back toward town on Goldstream. And we went down that. I went on kind of down the creek. Got down there a lot further than I should have gone, probably. I sat down and kind of watched the willows along the creek. I'd sat there for 15, 20 minutes. Then all of a sudden, here come a moose right at me, a bull. And I knocked him down, and then I finished him off with Bill's 30 Newton, so that was 2 shells shot. 2 more, so I'd use 3 of them. So then Bill finally showed up, and we dressed him out, and we had about 3 miles to pack, slightly up the hill, up the creek, and there was kind of a trail there for most part of it, but it was a long ways. We didn't have our pack boards with us, so we just took one little load up, and then we figured we'd come back the next day with our pack boards and finish packing out this moose. Well, anyway, we came back to town, and a buddy of mine, well, it was Bob Boyd and myself and my wife, we went up the Dease Highway to Faith Creek, and there was a mining road, and we got up there 4 or 5 miles up the creek on this old mining road and looked up on the hill, and there was a couple of caribou up there. So up the hill we go, and it was pretty steep up there. I know I had a 30 carbine, and I don't remember where I got it, but I had it. I brought it out of the military or something like that. But the three of us got up the hill, and we broke over the crest of this mountain, and as far as the eye could see, there was nothing but caribou. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. I'd never even dreamed of anything like that. We got a couple and we got back to town, and the next day I called the Fish and Game and told them what we'd seen. So they got a plane and they went up and looked, and they called back later that day and they said that was a herd of about 10,000, and we were right in the middle of it. The whole hill was just moving. As far as you could see, there was nothing but solid caribou. So that was a great experience. And I remember there was a guy named Fred Polk. He was up there with a buddy. And they were just upstream from us a ways, and Fred had wounded a nice big bull caribou, and it was still able to walk, so he was herding it down toward the pickup, so he didn't have to pack it. And his partner seen this caribou coming and shot him. So they had to end up packing it anyway. Well, anyway, we got to town, and there was more caribou crossing up the steep. And Bill wanted to go up, so I went up with him. So we got just above Faith Creek, where you get up on the high country, and then above the road, there's trees, and then you get up right on the top. There's kind of a ridge of open country. So we went up there, sat and waited. We didn't wait too long, and here comes some caribou. First bunch that come through, there were some other fellows up there, and they started to shoot. That bunch went by, and then another bunch come by, and I shot one of them, a nice bull. It was all downhill back to the road and come home. So that was the fourth shot I had used with Bill's 30 Newton. So I returned it to him with three shells, and I'd spent four of them with a caribou, a moose, and a bear. That wasn't bad. Then we went back out, and we packed that moose out. It took us two more trips. I guess we was a little soft. We brought the bones and all. There was no boning out. That was quite an experience.
Sounds like a real productive year.
It was, and that was the start of it. Since then, we have never bought red meat. We've always had moose, caribou, sheep in the locker. It's a lot of work. It's probably a little expensive in one way, but that was our recreation. And that's always been my feeling, even when I was trapping or we'd go up grayling fishing or something like that. We never put a price on the bounty that we got. The next year, that would be in 47, the kids were born in June of that year. I had bought myself a 300 H&H that was recommended by one of the trappers that took boot camp with me out of McGrath. Gee, I don't remember. It was just the first part of the season, I guess around the 10th or so, and I went up the Steese Highway up past Chattanooga. Gosh, there was an animal. It was real dark there, and I couldn't figure it out, but I looked through the scope on the rifle, and I could see horn, but I couldn't see the crosshair. So I just centered his front shoulders in the scope, and I fired, and I heard it hit. He didn't go very far, and he went down, and I was trying to figure out, now, how am I going to get this critter back to the road? Because it was a pretty good-sized one. A guy named Jim Mount and Earl McRae come by, and I had met them, I don't know, fishing or something. Anyway, they gave me a hand, and we got the moose out. We took it up to Wachter Brothers. They had a cooler, and they were going to cool it and cut it. Well, that was the only time I've had meat commercially cut. I don't think I got my own moose for one thing, and I got very few steaks. It was mostly just roasts and hamburgers, about all I got out of it. It was a nice animal. That continued my streak of put meat on the sable, and that's the same year that Bob Boyd and I hiked in sheep hunting into Jarvis Creek from the road, which was about a 12-mile hike to get in there. And luckily, we didn't get a sheep, but we didn't know what we was doing, for one thing. Slim Moore had a group of hunters in there, and they'd got five rams. And the weather turned sour, and we got scared, and we got out of there. But we didn't get a sheep. Slim was real nice. He said he'd haul the animals out for us if we got them. And then, of course, we got caribou that fall. Then we started hunting duck over on the Salt Jacket Slough. Boyd had got a riverboat and an old Johnson engine. And when we first started to go over there that fall, we'd go over after work, and we'd have our hip boots and so forth. And all we'd do over there is build a fire and lean against a tree, and that's the way we'd sleep. As soon as dawn got there, we was out in the pothole trying to hit duck. We always allowed our time to get back up to town and back to work at 8 o'clock. To this day, I can't believe how we done it. I don't. Pretty soon we started taking some comforters and a tarp, and then pretty soon somebody took a tent, and then we took lanterns, and oh man, then we had hog's heaven. But Boyd and I took lots and lots and lots of ducks off in that slough.
Okay, Bud, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of your wolf hunting adventures up north?
Well, my wolf hunting adventures were with Leroy Schiebel and Chuck Gray and Cleo McMahon. This one year, I remember, we went up in March. We spent the first night at Fort Yukon. It seems that they had us looking for a lost pilot that had gone up to on a training flight, so they asked us to look up in that area. So we did. And then the second day, we started up through the pass to go over to Peters Lake. We got into some wolves on a, I think they said it was Windy Creek. We got a couple out of a bunch there. There was a pack there. They'd killed three moose down in the timber. We got a couple of them anyway. We went back to Fort Yukon that night, and I remember it was about 42 below, and the next morning we got up and went on up toward Arctic Village, and of course we took the side streets and so forth along the way. After we'd gone over Arctic Village, and I believe we stopped there and got what gas we could get. We used Blazo and everything else in the aircraft. Whatever was available, it was a dollar a gallon, which in those days was expensive, but today is cheap. Anyway, we took off and went over the pass into Peter's Lake, and we got up the valley from Arctic Village, and we run into a pack of wolves. There was quite a bunch of them in there. I think we got five or six. Well, by the time we got them down and got some of them skinned, and seemed like we hauled one back to camp with us, and we buried a couple of them and for skinning in the morning, because late afternoon it was cold. And we stayed at the schoolhouse. It was a log building. I think the man's name was Mary or O'Mary, something like that. Anyway, when we got back there the night, he was cooking some caribou. And Cleo McMahon, being from down in Gacona along the Den Alley Highway, he didn't think much of the taste of those caribou. And Cleo said, well, boy, I've heard these Arctic caribou are just fantastic eating. So the school teacher there, he offered Cleo some caribou that he was frying up. And I thought Cleo was never going to stop eating. He said that was the best caribou that he'd ever eaten in his life, and he just kept eating and eating and eating. Anyway, stayed there. It was out of the weather. In the morning when we got up, it was either 65 or 67 below. And I have a picture of Chuck Gray hanging on the prop of his Super Cub, and it is not moving. It couldn't turn it.
Assume you had drained the oil and taken that inside and probably the battery in it.
No, we didn't the battery, just the oil. We drained that every night when we was up there wolf hunting and took it in where we could keep it warm. We had a canvas edging cover that came clean to the ground. And then we had a plumber's pot which burned blazo. And we'd put that underneath it until we got the engine warm. And then we'd put the oil in and take off as quick as we could.
So did you go flying that day?
Oh, yeah. And the next night over at Peter's Lake, it was 56 below. I don't remember whose cabin it was. There was a frame building there. We knew there was an oil stove in it, and we had some fuel oil with us, but every time we went into one of those cabins that had an oil stove in it, you had to fix the stove. I never did go in one of them that the stove worked. Anyway, we got it going, and we had a good night. In the morning, it was 56 below, and we just run into wolves every place on that trip. And we had a flight plan to be into Umiak that night. And I know when we went into Umiak, Leroy had wolf hides packed behind my head and on my lap. I don't think I could have shot if I'd have wanted to. We passed over some wolves that day because we were just full, and we wanted to get into Umiak before dark. But that was a cold one. The next morning we didn't go out because there at Umiak, I think it was about 40 below and there must have been about a 30 mile an hour wind. So we just stayed inside that time. But I'll never forget at Arctic Village, the temperature there, and then yeah, at Peter's Lake the next night. That was a cold one.
Another adventure, huh?
Right, right. But you talk about getting excited. When I first started to go wolf hunting with those fellas, the first one I got was just out of Livengood. Leroy and I were going along. We caught three of them on a lake there, and we got two of them. First ones I'd ever shot at. I shot at some cardboard boxes out here to get an idea of what was going on.
But I'll figure the lead and all that.
Anyway, my heart would just thump. Every time I'd see a wolf, I didn't care where or when it was. Every time it would just go boom, boom, boom.
It's been my experience that some of the people that hunt the wolves and have hunted them in the past respect them and admire them just as much as anybody else.
Well, anybody thinks it's easy and unsportsmanlike to hunt wolves from an airplane. It takes a lot of skill and it's dangerous. There's quite a few people that we knew got killed hunting wolves. If you go back and look at the records, when the state took over management of the big game in Alaska, that's about the time they stopped the wolf hunting from the air. But we had the highest ungulate population that was ever known. And the wolves were still there. There was plenty of wolves. We had thinned them down and controlled them, where the ungulates had a chance to come back. It's been going downhill ever since. And the furs that we harvested were worth a lot of money, and anybody who thinks it is easy to do and an unsportsman has never done it. And I've done it for a good many years. I'm pretty good at skinning and spotting them, too. And I was pretty good help on getting them up in the morning and get the plane fire potted and everything, get things going, because I loved it so well. So we got a lot of wolves, and I sure feel that there's room for a lot of that trait today, because to harvest the wolf, because we're losing a lot of valuable fur because they're killing each other off, even though they're killing the ungulates too.
Great stuff from one of the guys who did it all long before Alaska was even a state. Now let's hear from our sponsors. The next time you stop into any of our sponsors, please thank them for supporting our program. And now back to the show, where Bud Wiese will talk about several family hunts and the values he passed along to his children and grandchildren.
I was starting to trap at that time. My first trap line was where the Chena Pump Station Road is now. That was a railroad track. They had picked up the rails and the ties to drive down as far as the Tanana, and there was nobody living on that side of the Chena at that time. We could trap fox out there. The Tanana, I did pick up a mink or two, I know. But then pretty soon people started to get dogs and letting them run loose, and I'd catch a dog now and then, and so I just quit trap as soon as that happened, because I had a love for dogs. I didn't want to hurt any of them, and so I quit trapping there, and then I moved out on the Yankovich Road, and Mike Yankovich was the only one that lived out there then. There was some alders, and there was some lynx tracks, and I put a rabbit trap in one spot, and I tied it short. Then about 6 feet on each side of that in the trail, I hung a lynx snare. By gosh, I come back, I had a rabbit and a lynx and each snare right there on the Yankovich Road. From there, people started to show up out in that area. So then I started to hike into Goldstream. And as far as you could go was the Golf and Country Club there at Blaine Road. There was no Blaine Road. That was a survey trail that went straight over the hill. Well, I would snowshoe from there over the hill and down in the valley, and there were some lakes down there. And we packed our traps. Boyd was with me, stuff, and we'd trap beavers and mink and lynx. There was a wolf come through a couple times. We never had luck on that. It was mostly just muskrat and beaver and mink. There was nobody living in Goldstream at that time, and not one person. One year, I took 25 beaver out of there. Well, Jack Bobee followed my snowshoe trail over into the valley, and he was the first one that homesteaded over there. He followed mine with skis down to where mine went downstream, and he kind of went upstream a little bit. That's where he homesteaded, and of course, that opened it up, and then everybody went out. When that got civilized, then I moved up on the Chattanooga and trapped up in that area and along the old Murphy Dome Road, and then we trapped out on the ridge from Clary Summit out toward the between Fairbanks Creek and the Chattanooga. About then is when snow machines showed up, and that made trapping a different story altogether. Probably the early 60s. About the last year I trapped, I'd been out by near Satana Olness hunting rabbits, and I seen quite a few lynx tracks there. And it was late in the spring, probably in February. So on the next day off I had, I took some traps and snares up there for lynx. That winter we had very little snow, and I had a snow machine, I think it was an Alpine, so it was probably close to 1970 or in there someplace. I'd pretty well give up because people were following my trail, and every place I was going, they're picking up my traps and throwing them out in the woods and sticking sticks in them. And one interesting thing there, when I end of the season and pick up my traps and snares, I took the wife with me on that particular trip. We went up and I was picking up snares as I went along the way, and she says, "What do you do that for? There's no animal dumb enough to stick their neck in a snare." Well, we hadn't gone a half a mile and here a lynx had got in the snare right in the middle of the trail. So she got an education on that.
Okay, Bud, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the family members you hunt with and some of your experiences there.
As I said, we had twin girls born in 1947. They were raised on wild game, like moose, caribou, and sheep, and bear. The wife would shred it down for them, make baby food out of it. And as soon as they got around 8, 9, or 10, I bought a small rifle for them and had it cut down so that we could participate in the junior small bore rifle shooting at the Tanana Valley Sportsman's Association range. And they became very good shots. Both Anna and Mary have killed a moose. Anna's killed several of them, and they both have killed caribou, then along with the ducks, and they've got lots of grouse and rabbits. We don't take our limit as a rule. We take what we can use. I remember one time Bill and Anna and I were out sheep hunting. It was five nice rams before we started to even stock them. We decided we only wanted two of them. Though we could have used all three, but we only decided two. And in the fall, when moose season is on, with our group, we could probably take five, six, seven, eight. A three is the most I know we've ever taken. It's usually just two. And we do our own meat cutting, utilize that meat to 100%.
So that's kind of part of the experience too, isn't it? To get together with the group afterwards and process the meat.
That's right. We work together to get it and to process it. So it's really an accomplishment. And sometimes I wonder if it's worth all the work. We sure enjoy it. We picked berries, and we still pick them. I try to pick about 10 to 15 gallons of blueberries and another 10 or 15 gallons of low bush cranberries every year. Yeah, we use them for a juice. We put in a garden, and we put up our own vegetables. And there was one little short hunt I should mention, and I think it was 1990 or 1991, Anna hadn't been out hunting with us for about 15 years. She was raising her family. So that fall, we decided we'd go in with the big rig, and we'd take my grandson, her oldest son, Brian. Brian and I went down, and we got a caribou permit for the Delta area. And then Bill and Anna and Clem came down, and we went in. As I say, it was the first time Anna had been with us for about 15 years. Well, the first thing we found was two nice big caribou, nice big bulls. And so we stalked them, and Brian shot one, and Anna shot the other. Just perfect. And then we went up into the mountains, and Brian got a sheep. It was just a fantastic hunt to show you how the party hunts together. Over the years, I don't know how many moose I've got. I've always just tried to take what I know is going to be utilized. Right today, it's the same way. We just take what we can use. We don't go out and get our limits. We just feel that we'll take what we need and let it go at that. I wasn't brought up to waste anything, and I've tried to instill that on my kids.
Judging from what you told me, it sounds like they had a good teacher.
Well, I hope so. I always tried to set a good example. Let's see if we can get into some more hunting stories. As I said, I was into Jarvis Creek in 1947. Since then, I've hunted to the east of Jarvis, but never into Riley Creek or Jarvis since then. So when we decided to go in this year, knowing that my health wouldn't allow me to do much climbing, I told my son-in-law that we'd go in late, like we did one year before, and we caught the sheep down low. So I said, I want to go in and look in Riley Creek to see how far we could get up and then do the same with Jarvis Creek. Well, we got up Riley not very far. We seen a couple of three-quarter curl rams, but that was as far as we could go, and it looked pretty hungry. So we dropped back down, and then we went up Jarvis Creek. Well, the time we got into Jarvis Creek and got up there quite a ways, it was getting dusk. So we went as far as we could without getting into big boulders and stuff like that, which would have been hard on the equipment. Why, we camped right there on the river. And in the morning when we woke up, we looked off to the west, and there was a bunch of rams over there. My son-in-law and my nephew said, man, there's a couple of nice ones over there. And we decided we'd go over and get them. And they wanted to cook breakfast. And I said, with my heart condition, it'd be too rough on me. I said, I'll have a little shot of tea. I can do better walking if we go without breakfast. So we took off. And we got over there, and they picked out the ram. And I got behind a nice big boulder, which was in good range. They told me which one was the best one by far. And they were telling, this one is a nice one, but he's groomed on one side. And then there's another one that's groomed on both sides. But there was one that was really nice. The ram came into a good view, so I touched one off and I heard it hit him. And I was really excited. I just let a war whoop out of me, and I said, I hit him.
This was 59 years after your first caribou hunt up at the rapids above Tanana, and it was just as big of an adventure as that first one.
Yeah, that's right. All my hunting adventures are big. I don't know, I just never wear out them. They kept their glasses on him, and then he went down. It's a very, very beautiful sheep. In fact, I've hunted that area off and on since 47. I have seen one other that was fairly close to this in being a perfect set of horns. I've got a lot of nice horns out of there, but nothing compared to this one. This has got a 41 and a half curl. Both sides are just perfect. The base is 14, the spread is 30. The cape is a nice long hair because we got it on the 16th of September. It's just unbelievable.
And you got to share it with your son-in-law and nephew?
Well, they like to go hunting just like I do. They more or less followed my footsteps. They are good hunters, very good. So I was privileged to have them go along, and they did practically all the work, picked out the animal. So that was a great adventure. Probably my last sheep hunt, but it was sure wonderful. Always worked with fish and game. I got involved with the Tanana Valley Sportsman Association in 1946. I've been a member ever since. I think the TVSA membership for years, especially under federal, we probably wrote the laws and seasons and bag limits for the Fairbanks area. It was very productive. We had lots of input from people that were not selfish. They knew the game and knew what the circumstances were. So we worked very close with the fish and game. I was one of the original members of the Wildlife Safeguard, and I followed that for a good many years. I've always been interested in good management.
We're getting towards the end of our time here, but if you wanted to maybe kind of sum up your attitude towards all these adventures that you had and how important they've been to you.
Well, I think they've been extremely important, not only to the utilization of the game that we've harvested and the fish we've taken, but also the berries in the garden. We all participate in the harvesting, and like the meat cutting and wrapping, we divide it up. Whoever wants it or needs it can have it. And we are a very close family. And I think this hunting and fishing and berry picking has just contributed to this immensely. That it's given us a closeness in our family, that we work together, and it's real important to our lifestyle, our Alaska way of life. It's being carried on by my daughters and my son-in-law, and I think it's just something a lot of people miss by not going out and enjoying this way of life of harvesting game and take what you need and take care of it and utilizing.
That's all for today. I hope you enjoyed the last two episodes where we heard from Bud Wiese, one of the grand old men of interior Alaska outdoorsmen.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.